right, this is the third and final session talking about the life cycle. Tomorrow we'll talk about a different cycle, and Friday at a different one. In the first talk we talked about the part of the life cycle when one looks forward and winds into life, and at the same time one looks backward and winds out of life. In the talk immediately preceding this talk, we left off talking about the postmortem phase of the cycle, where everything unwinds and it unwinds out of the various states of matter and bodies that we have that correspond to them. We left off talking about second heaven in the region of concrete thought. We were speaking about extracting the essence of thought by thinking back from consequence to cause, and by seeing what the consequence was versus what we were thinking we were doing in the first place. So in all of these things, whether in the desire world or in the etheric retrospection or in the world of thought, what we are doing is we're harvesting the truth, and we can now harvest it with objectivity. In all of these unwindings, the forms are disintegrated, they're dissolved, and the spirit, which is the watcher, looks at the essence and sees the essence into its own being. It's a very interesting thing. We think about that in the opposite direction. If we're watching a pool game or something like that, we try to watch the ball into the pocket. In short, we try to use our thought to watch something to where we want it to go, and that's what really aiming or steering or something like that is. But when one is looking at one's thoughts, what one is doing is taking the essence of them into the self, which, you know, it's watching it into the self. Now, there is some tendency to think that in the world of concrete thought that this is the same that it was in the desire world or in the etheric. It isn't, because things in the world of thought don't dissolve as much as they do in the desire world, and they don't dissolve nearly at all as much as things dissolve in the etheric realms. Thoughts and thought forms, even though we re-examine them and draw the essence out of them, the thoughts may live on for many centuries. That's because the closer we get to the spirit, the more long-lived things are, until they approach that state which is beyond time, where things exist eternally. This means that they are more harmonious and they are more unified, and they are therefore closer to the source of things, and there's less imperfection there, even though our mind is very, very young in its development. Even in the desire world, some of the forms are relatively long. In the world of thought, it's common to find thought forms that live thousands or millions of years. Not necessarily human thought forms that live that long, but usually thought forms produced by the divine creative hierarchies, who are much stronger thinkers than we are. They can produce thought forms that last for an extraordinarily long time, like the thought form of the whole business, of the whole creation. This is important even in simple human soul growth. Suppose someone dies, and they die in a flame, and all the records are lost out of the ethers before they have a chance to harvest them. Some provision can be made for that, but usually the experience is lost. It's not lost forever, but it's lost. And what usually happens, or at least what the Rosicrucian seers have found, is that such an individual who died and lost all the records in their previous life is brought to be brought to birth in such a way that they die in childhood. And when they die in childhood, because the desire body hasn't been born, it can't die. Since it hasn't really been spun in, it can't unspin. And so what happens when a child dies is it's immediately taken to the desire world and waits for a new rebirth. And in that interval, it is given objective lessons in morality and the consequences of desires, usually by juxtaposition of very sweet desires with very harsh, negative, destructive desires. And then they're given not the same thing as they would have gotten if they had received everything from their past life, if nothing had been lost, but they're given some help. Well, nothing is ever completely lost, because there is a memory of everything that has happened in the archetypes in the world of thought. So eventually a person will be able to recoup everything from that life that where the records were lost in the ethers, because that still exists in the world of thought. But the matter of it is that it'll be a long time before most, you know, lives, a number of lives before most people will be able to read in the world of thought and to recoup that. Moreover, when one gets it out of the world of thought, it's not the same thing. It's not in the order of things. It's not in the order where the physical and etheric dissolve and go back into the desire world, which goes back into the world of thought. And when things are seen out of sequence, they don't have the same effect. And so that's not the intended life pattern. But at any rate, there is a provision that nothing is lost. I would imagine that someone who eventually gets the information back out of the world of thought, this is only speculation, that they would have a unique insight on things because the order of things in life is changed. Just like people who, when their parents die, that's a case of the older generation dying before it, or even worse, when a child dies, the parents grieve horribly because, you know, the younger generation is supposed to succeed. You know, if a parent dies prematurely, a child is forced into maturity before the child is ready, because it often has to take some of the responsibility of the parents. And the consequence of that is a very different outlook on life, a very serious outlook on life, because the child has never had a chance to be a child. And I think when the order of things has changed, something, everything changes in the consciousness of the person. The postmortem work in the world of thought, when one extracts the essence of thought experience, is very hard to name. It would be nice to call it unthinking, but unthinking already means something else in the language. The same is true. Perhaps the best grammar would be to call it rethinking, as like in reset, but we already have another meaning for rethinking, and so that doesn't work. With or without a word, it's important to remember the principle of the process that works throughout the whole postmortem, the unwinding principle and the extraction principle. Right. Even in the world of thought, we have to apply the same thing. We have to own up, or we have to really see whether it was what we thought we were doing in the first place. Because if we don't do that, then we go on with the delusion that our thoughts are what we want them to be, and they're going to accomplish what we want to accomplish in them. It's not quite the same thing in the desire world. During the night, I thought of a way of talking about the desire world that's a little bit better. I'm sure that we've all done something where you say something to somebody else and you wished you hadn't said it. And you say, I wish I could take it back. And when you are in purgatory, in the postmortem existence, that's exactly what you have to do. You have to take it back. But you have to take it back as the person who took it in the first place. So it's also very important in the world of thought that everything is intentional, that one intentionally gives one's attention to comparing the thought when doing the unthinking. Now there's another word that is also often used for the unwinding work in the world of thought, which is used in many ways, but it has a deeper sense in the spiritual worlds. A lot of words that have meaning in the regular vocabulary have a deeper meaning in spiritual things. And that word is remembering. Now, normally when we think of remembering, we think of recalling memories from the past. But if we look at the origin of that word, it is remembering. Like our arm, for example, is a member, and we're reattaching something. Only in the case of remembering in the world of thought, we are taking the essence of our thoughts and we are remembering them into the ideas from which they have come. So this is a little bit different use of the a different use of that word. When it is taken back into the original idea from which it came, that idea is transcendental. It is beyond anything concrete. It has a universal quality, and there is then a unification. Everything in the phenomenal worlds, that is the concrete worlds, the concrete mind, the concrete desires, the concrete ethers, and the concrete chemical stuff, everything is built in those realms by separation. Those are the realms of separation. The best example of that is our bodies are built by separation. Cells split in half and break, break up and form a new form, or form the form that is there all along. Everything in the spiritual worlds, in the transcendent realms, everything is accomplished by unification. Everything is brought to a state of oneness. Mm-hmm. And this brings us to the ultimate end of that second phase of the cycle, the unwinding phase, or the winding out of matter. And it also brings us to the ultimate source and the ultimate end of the whole of the life cycle. It brings us to the individual self, to the threefold spirit, because all of our thoughts come from ideas in the universal spirit, and the focus of that self or spiritual ego is in the region of abstract thought. So this process brings up another word that is used differently in the mystery teachings than it is used in the common vocabulary. It's a word that Max Heindel uses a lot, but he never clearly defines it. And that is the word assimilation. The important part of the word assimilation is the simulation part. Some people use the word absorption and assimilation to mean the same thing, and they are not the same thing. Absorption is the process of extracting and taking up something. Assimilation is the process of putting it in its right place. For example, assimilation in the physical body, when we take in nutriment, that nutriment is assimilated to different parts of the body. For example, the brain doesn't want any protein. It assimilates sugar to itself. The brain lives on sugar, and people who are very mental people have to be very careful because they often have a real strong drive for sugar. The heart, which is a muscle that burns a lot of fuel, it assimilates oil. So it takes something that the brain doesn't even want. The type of food is very different for the two of them. So assimilation, in the sense of what we're talking about now, is that the meaning of the thoughts and the meaning of all the soul material, whether it was taken out of the desire body with the seed atom, or whether it was taken out of the vital body with the seed atom, or whether it was taken from the seed atom of the dense physical body, all of that is assimilated, and it goes back to the parent idea. And in that parent idea, it finds its home, and in the essence of what has been learned is sort of a soul material, which is a very simple form of experience that actually gives life and light to the spirit. I don't know how to say it any other way. It's hard to say it, to describe some of these things in human terms, especially if you don't know them very well, which is the boat that we're in. But what happens is we have our creative dream of what we wanted our life to be. And when we take the essence of that creative dream and of the manifestation of that creative dream and bring it back to the ideas out of which the creative dream was made of before, it becomes a very vivid picture. It's like something we do all the time. If we have a dream of something we would like to paint, suppose our creative activity is as a painter, we get this dream and we make the painting, and it's never what we wanted. But something has happened in the process of manifesting it. If we had kept it in the dream state, we would become nothing but dreamers, and there would be no progress in that. But when we try to work it out and we struggle with the limitations of the paint and perspective and all of those kinds of things, when we take it back into the spirit, it wasn't what we dreamed in the first place, but what we dreamed in the first place is much more vivid because it has the essence of the experience of the manifestation of the trying to do it. And this is how the spirit grows. Its capacity to become a divine creative being comes by trying to create. And our lives are our creations. Ultimately, that's all we really have, is our lives. And that's what Barbara was talking about this afternoon. It is the quality of our lives is the only thing that we're really going to get out of this. It's the only thing that we really have. All right, and so we've understood assimilation a little bit. So it's not clear. I think it is something like a unification principle, that when we see something into the spirit in the process of unwinding the thought forms as much as we can unwind them, that they automatically go back to their home place. It's almost like you focus something through a lens, and when you bring it back through the lens the other way, it follows the same focal path and it comes home. So I'm sure that that path is not a visual path as much as it is something like an association, like we associate this with that and it comes through, because everything in the spiritual world is not quite as graphic and physical as we like to make it here. Now, we've been looking at the meanings of different words like remembering and assimilation. Let's look at another word. Let's look at a word in Greek. And that word in Greek is aletheia. It's a word that we run into often. Aletheia, idealists marry Alice's, because Alice is taken from Alicia, or any of those names, Elise, the lady that lives at Oceanside, those are all taken from aletheia. Now, aletheia in Greek is composed of two words, a, which means without. Like when we say somebody is amoral, or when we say somebody is atheistic, it means they are without God. In this case, aletheia means forgetting. It comes from the river in the underworld called Lethe, the river Lethe, which was the river of forgetfulness. So aletheia means without forgetfulness. And do you know what that word means in Greek? That's the word for truth. If you never forget, as in when Christ says, I am the truth, and if you say this, as Christ did, this do in remembrance of me, if you never forget the life spirit, you never forget the truth. And so that same quality is there. So we're talking about forgetting. We're never forgotten by Christ, because our self, that selfhood that we're talking about, that idea, that threefold spirit, is a condensation from the life spirit. The self is from the selfness, and that selfness is the selfness of all beings in our cosmos. And so that always remembers us. That is the nature of Christ. So when we, well, it happens to us all the time. When we get up out of bed in the morning and we say, today's the day I'm not going to forget Christ, or today's the day I'm going to do this, and I'm never going to let it slip on me. And within a few seconds, we could say to ourselves, oh, I forgot myself. And it is something like that kind of remembering that builds things back into the spirit. Now, this brings us to the very, very end of the second phase of the cycle. This was one of those recapitulations that covered everything new from why we did it last night. And this is an extremely important point in the cycle. It's the spiritual high point. You might say it is the origin of the whole cycle that we're talking about, the life cycle. After we looked at the etheric panorama, and there was nothing left of the physical etheric for us to focus in, we refocused in the desire world. And after the unwinding of the lower and higher desire bodies in their own particular time and manner of doing it, there was nothing of desire